and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentations, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question at that time, you may press star one. This conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Jim Schlindinger. You may begin.
Thank you, Marianne. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us on today's conference call, and we're very, very happy to have Dr. Richard Hunt present about blast injuries and bombings, injury patterns, and care. So this is a great, timely, unfortunately, topic, which I hope we won't have to use the information, but it's always good to know in case we have to. Dr. Hunt has been the director of the Division of Injury Response here at the CDC and the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control since 2004. From 98 to 2004, Dr. Hunt was professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the State University of New York, SUNY, and Upstate Medical University at Syracuse. Before his work in New York, Dr. Hunt served from 1988 to 98 as the Department of Emergency Medicine at East Carolina University, where he became vice chair of the department and served as the medical director of the Helicopter and Ground Critical Care Transport Service. In January 2004, Dr. Hunt was selected by CDC's Injury Center to head the Division of Injury Response. Since his appointment, he has led the division in the direction setting processes which resulted in a new division name, a realignment and new vision and mission and focus priorities. He's currently guiding research and preparedness activities in disaster and terrorism response as it relates to injuries and fostering partnerships with the acute care injury community that will be crucial in any kind of mass casualty or natural disaster type of event. So we're very pleased to have Dr. Hunt. He is also going to be assisted by several of his staff on the question and answer part, and he will introduce them by name. I turn it over to you, Dr. Hunt. We thank you for presenting this very important and timely information today.
Thank you for that kind introduction. Thanks very much for those on the call today for the opportunity to speak with you today. The subject matter experts in our division who are joining me on this call and may be assisting me with some of the questions will be Dr. Paula Burgess, Dr. Ernie Sullivan, and Dr. Scott Sasser, all emergency physicians in our division who have been working on this particular topic. The Institute of Medicine's report on the future of emergency care in the United States brings focus to the issue of terrorist bombings. Slide, please. Some of those quotes follow. Explosions are the most common cause of casualties associated with terrorism. A second quote from that same report is as follows. More basic weapons, including conventional bombs and improvised explosive devices, appear to be the primary terrorist threats facing the United States today. Some background of what I'm going to be talking about today. We're going to be discussing patient care challenges, systems challenges, and also resources that are available to you from the CDC. Next slide. So how is it that we came to the slides and the content of this presentation? One is certainly the scientific literature. Secondly, we're most grateful for the input from our United States military, the medical sector, who have been engaged in conflict overseas and their experiences with explosions. Then third, the civilian medical folks who've responded to international terrorist bombings. And we've been really fortunate in having medical personnel from multiple countries really engage with us in helping us learn about how to better prepare and respond to terrorist attacks that they've actually had experience in. Luckily, we've not had the misfortune of having to deal with this over the past few years, and their experiences have really been invaluable. As we have learned from both our United States military colleagues and those international civilian healthcare providers and public health folks, we've recognized that really there is a big difference in bombings in open spaces versus bombings in closed spaces. And a pretty easy way to describe that is much of what you see on TV these days and when you open up your web news sites is really describes open bombings for improvised explosive devices that occur in open spaces. And in addition, there are closed space bombings. And the way to easily think about that is the train bombings. In many of those cases, the doors on those trains have been closed. And the resultant patterns and severity of injury in those circumstances are different in many ways, particularly in reference to severity. The last piece of background that has been extraordinarily important for us here at the Division of Injury Response is a partnership that we have called the TIDE Partnership. Someone said only the government can make up an acronym like that. Next slide. This is a partnership that we in our Division of Injury Response has with nine different partner organizations. The partnership is entitled the Terrorism Injuries Information Dissemination and Exchange Project. And it's pretty self-explanatory. But if you take a look at the entities' logos on that slide, you'll see truly there is quite a bit of representation from both public health and the injury care provider sector, including the American Medical Association, the National Native American EMS Association, the State and Territorial Injury Prevention Directors Association, the American College of Emergency Physicians, the National Association of EMTs, the National Association of EMS Physicians, the American College of Surgeons, the American Trauma Society, and the National Association of State EMS Directors. And much of the information enclosed in this presentation really has evolved out of our partnership with these entities. Next slide. Some more background. Explosive use is increasing in terrorist events. There are indeed unique patient care and system challenges that I'll go into in more depth over the next few slides. Some recent examples follow. In the Mumbai bombing in India on July 11, 2006, seven bombs were placed on commuter trains during rush hour. 209 were killed and over 700 were injured. In Tel Aviv, Israel, on January 19, 2006, a suicide bomber in a small fast food restaurant killed himself and wounded 20 others. Most of the customers were outside the restaurant, but the bomber went inside and detonated the bomb. The London subway bombing, July 11, 2005. Ironically, the TIDE partnership was meeting on that day. In the London subway bombing, three bombs on the underground train and one bomb on a bus killed 56, including the four terrorists, and injured over 700. 350 required hospital treatment. 22 were admitted in serious or critical condition. The Madrid train bombing of March 11, 2004. 10 bombs exploded in four commuter trains, killing 177 instantly and injuring more than 2,000. 14 people died later. And then in a Tel Aviv disco on June 1, 2001, a suicide bomber killed 20 and injured 120. The terrorist mingled with a large group of teenagers who were standing in line to enter a disco. While still in line, he then detonated the explosive strapped to his body. The explosive charge contained a large number of metal objects, including balls and screws, designed to increase the extent of injuries. Lastly, our military experience, which we are increasingly gaining knowledge about, and as I said, we're working carefully with our military partners to gather and glean information that might be helpful to us. Next slide, please. The experience of the United States healthcare provider. Again, from the Institute of Medicine report on the future of emergency care, a quote, few EMS personnel have any training or experience assessing the scene of a terrorist bombing or evaluating casualties for a range of potential injuries. While that quote comes directly from the EMS section of that report, I would suggest that that echoes the experience of other injury care providers, including emergency physicians, trauma surgeons, and others who may be called on to provide a response to terrorist injuries, terrorist bombing injuries. My own experience, 15 years clinically as an attending physician in two large major tertiary care level one trauma centers, each with volumes of approximately 50,000 patients, my own clinical experience is one terrorist, or actually it wasn't a terrorist, but a bombing victim. But as I go across the country and talk with my colleagues professionally, that echoes those experiences as well, their experiences as well. It also turns out that we will, sadly, but in some regards, fortunate enough to learn from those military medical care providers who've gained experience over the past few years on the global war on terrorism. So that will certainly add to our experience, in particular in probably open space bombings, but again, closed space bombings are also important to realize we may need to respond to as well. Next slide. Some of the actual patient care challenges. There are unique patterns of injury in patients who are injured as a result of terrorist bombings. It turns out that as many as half of the patients seek care in the very first hour following a bombing. A particular challenge is that severely injured patients arrive after less injured patients. So many resources may already be allocated to the less injured patients, and then suddenly the severely injured will require significant amounts of attention and resources that you may have already allocated. And then, unlike the way we typically think about trauma with a division between penetrating trauma and blunt trauma, I mean, you go to any institution and we see a lot of blunt trauma or we see a lot of penetrating trauma, but rarely is it that it's sort of, well, we get this perfect mix of both in one patient. Well, the sad part is these patients injured from terrorist bombings have multiple penetrating trauma and blunt trauma as well. Next slide. Some other key concepts, confined space or structural collapse. I already alluded to the confined space, the closed space. It increases the morbidity and mortality from these events. Primary blast injury occurs mostly from confined spaces. Standard triage, trauma resuscitation, treatment, and transfer. Those are the things to always gravitate to. If you can't remember the nuance from this, when you actually have to respond, gravitate to those standard triage, trauma, resuscitation, treatment, and transfer standards that you've adhered to for years. Gravitate to those, realizing that there are nuances that hopefully we can either push out to you or you can access very, very rapidly. But it's important to realize that what you've done before will work for a lot, maybe not quite all, but it will work for a lot. And then the other piece, the other key concept is, you know, I think almost any clinical lecture I've ever given has had this these two words, repeat exams, on. And it's in the spirit of not missing anything. But in particular, when we have little to no experience in actually caring for patients with multiple penetrating trauma and blunt trauma from explosions that have ball bearings included in the devices and things that we're not familiar with, the repeat exam is truly, it's one in retrospect I should have bolded on this slide. As you think about key concepts for this, it turns out that when you review these civilian terrorist bombings, up to 20% may have critical injuries, and up to 75% of patients will actually self-refer by private vehicle. Next slide. I really want to focus this time we have together on the actual patient care and systems issues, the physics of blast injuries, what primary blast, secondary, et cetera, et cetera. Those kinds of physics are described in depth among a lot of different sources. But I would like to provide an overview of blast injuries. Primary injury is caused by a blast wave from the overpressure phenomena. Secondary injury is caused by flying debris, as in shrapnel-like wounds that may occur from the flying debris. Tertiary injury is caused by the blast wind. That blast wind is actually different from the blast wave itself. The wind is actually forced superheated airflow, and that can cause forceful impact. And then quaternary injury that can be caused by other vectors, including heat and radiation. Next slide. I want to start with lung injury. This slide shows images from those with lung injury as a result of explosions. On the slide, you see the reference for this. But in a series of patients with pulmonary blast injury, the butterfly pattern of pulmonary infiltrate was the most common radiologic finding and consists of bilateral central infiltrates. Those butterfly-like pulmonary infiltrates you can see in the image labeled A with bilateral central consolidation, very much like a lung contusion seen on a chest x-ray. Then a view of the CT scan, and then in letter B, letter C shows the axial chest CT scan. Interestingly, and it's really tough to see even on mine, there's a white arrow indicating pneumothorax, and indeed in pulmonary blast injury, lung blast injury, you can have pneumothorax and pneumomediastinum. Next slide. For lung injury, the signs of lung injury are usually present on initial presentation, but indeed may be delayed up to 48 hours. Lung injuries after explosions have been found to be more common in concert with skull fractures, greater than 10% body surface area burns, penetrating injury to the head or torso. It turns out that if you take a look at the lung pathology, it really varies quite widely from scattered petechiae to actual confluent hemorrhages. It's very much suspected in anyone that has pretty much any symptom or sign related to lung injury or lung problems, including dyspnea, cough, hemoptysis, or chest pain. Additional ones may be tachypnea, hypoxia, wheezing, decreased breath sounds, and obviously cyanosis. And again, just to reinforce that chest x-ray butterfly pattern, which was demonstrated previously. Next slide. Treatment for lung injury after bomb injuries. Certainly, just like any other lung injury, lung problem, high flow oxygenation. Then fluid management. Really think of lung injury following an explosion as very much in the same kind of context that you do pulmonary contusion. You really want to ensure that adequate tissue perfusion, but simultaneously avoid volume overload. Those of you who have treated pulmonary contusion before, it's that delicate balance that you're trying to maintain, and indeed that's the case with these patients. Endotracheal intubation is mandated for massive hemoptysis, impending airway compromise, or respiratory failure. A couple of key points here. Positive pressure ventilation could easily result in alveolar rupture or air embolism. And another caveat in the literature is that you need to consider selective bronchus intubation if you have severe hemoptysis or significant air leaks. Next slide. While it goes in some without saying, but I think because pneumothorax and hemothorax are certainly part of the profile of these patients, prompt decompression is certainly indicated. And then if the patient's going to undergo general anesthesia or air transport, really need to consider that prophylactic chest tube. Air embolism, which I mentioned briefly. Air embolism can occur as a result of these injuries. it can present in many, many different forms, like ear embolisms are prone to do, symptoms of stroke while you're taking care of the patient, myocardial infarction, acute abdomen, blindness, deafness, spinal cord injury or claudication. All you need to really think the ear embolism as the culprit for that. Treatment for suspected ear embolism, left lateral or prone position, and hyperbaric oxygenation. While there aren't any definitive, series of studies that show these are the kinds of indications for who you might be able to discharge, patients with a normal chest X-ray and normal ABG after 4 to 6 hours of observation seems to be probably a reasonable way to go. And again, that's not with a whole lot of experience with these, but seems like a reasonable plan of action. Next slide. Head injuries. Moving on to head injuries. This one I think is really worth some time thinking about. It turns out that, the way I think many of us think about head injury is the blow to the head. And either a blow to the head or the patient, hit the sidewalk, hit a wall, or was struck. And it turns out that, indeed, the primary blast wave itself can cause concussion, mild traumatic brain injury without a direct blow to the head. So, again, the blast wave can cause a head injury independently of the head actually striking the object or the object striking the head. And for that reason, it's really important that you think about head injury because concussions, mild traumatic brain injury are common after explosions. The military is definitely experiencing this, and as well as those international experiences, they're easily overlooked because the obvious question in the trauma room or pre-op care, well, did you hit your head or did you get hit by something? And the answer is no. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have a head injury. Next slide. In considering this, it's important to realize the proximity of the victim to the blast, particularly when, you have a patient that complains of loss of consciousness, headache, fatigue, poor concentration, lethargy, amnesia, or other constitutional symptoms, and also recognize that for those of you caring for patients after the immediate event, that symptoms of concussion and post-traumatic stress disorder can be very similar. So don't just chalk it up to being post-traumatic stress disorder, but think concussion is a possibility. Next slide. Abdominal injury. Gas-filled structures are the most vulnerable, especially the colon. The presentation of abdominal injuries might include bowel perforation, hemorrhage, which can range, again, like we talked about with the lung injury, small petechial hemorrhages to large hematomas, mesenteric shear injuries, solid organ lacerations, or testicular rupture. You could suspect it, I take a look at these symptoms, I'm going to read these symptoms, but you're going to say, well, this is very much like any other abdominal injury kind of symptoms and signs, and yes, you're right. Suspect this in anyone with abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, hematemesis, rectal pain, tenesmus, testicular pain, or unexplained hypovolemia. The clinical signs initially can be very subtle, and then it tips over the edge, and then you've got an acute abdomen or sepsis, which is very advanced. Next slide. Ear injury. I just did lung, head, and abdomen, and now we're doing ears. Now, why would we spend time about ears? Turns out that the tympanic membrane rupture is the most common primary blast injury. And that is important in a lot of different ways. The signs of ear injury are usually evident on presentation. Indeed, in talking with civilian international medical care providers, they talked about that quite a bit as being recognized even on the scene by the pre-hospital care providers. It also, I think it's really important to realize that isolated tympanic membrane rupture is not necessarily a marker for morbidity. Some numbers from the Madrid train bombings. Tympanic membrane rupture was found in 99 of 243 patients in one series of those patients. Of the 17 critically injured patients, 13 had ruptured tympanic membranes and 4 did not. So again, it's not necessarily a marker for morbidity. And then the issue of communications. It's very difficult to communicate with these folks with bilateral tympanic membrane rupture, which indeed does occur. Next slide. Other injury issues include traumatic amputation, which is a marker for multi-system injuries. Certainly, the consideration of delayed primary closure for grossly contaminated wounds. And we've learned from our colleagues, military and civilian, that after the consequences of these terrorist bombings indeed do result in grossly contaminated wounds in many cases. Assess immunization status. Realize that compartment syndrome, rhabdomyolysis, and acute renal failure are associated with explosions that have resulted in structural collapse, prolonged extrication, and severe burns. And, you know, the focus on, well, it was a bomb that went off, but don't neglect that indeed there may have been a structural collapse, prolonged extrication, severe burns that result in those events just like you do in your daily practice. Then there's the possibility of exposure to inhaled toxins, such as carbon monoxide, cyanide, and methemoglobin. Realize also there may be a significant percentage of injured patients with serious eye injuries. Next slide. There, as I mentioned, there are no definitive guidelines on disposition. I think it's prudent to admit second and third trimester pregnancies. The placental attachment is at risk from primary blast that causes spalling, and the blast wave itself can cause some shearing injuries and placental disruption. Close follow-up of wounds, and the reason for that, certainly the contamination, plus the patterns of wounds, the actual foreign bodies, something to really follow up about, and also the head injury. Without the history that you're used to, that's something to really follow up on. The seriousness of the eye injuries, tympanic membrane rupture, and the stress-related complaints, which may go on for some time. Patients with ear injury may have long-term tinnitus or deafness, and you know, again, the importance of the ear injury with communications and any discharge instructions for those folks probably need to be written. Next slide, please. A consequence of terrorist bombings are the mental health issues. And while, indeed, we're talking about terrorist bombings today, what is on this slide and my comments about the mental health issues apply just as much to the challenges that our nation is having with, in reaction to, in response to, the shootings at Virginia Tech. So these definitely apply to mass casualty events, whatever the actual incident is. Factors that precipitate the mental health problems are the event occurs with little or no warning. There's an unknown duration. Will it happen again? The personal threat. And then the unknown. For example, five train bombs go off, and then there's a bus bomb that goes off. The sequelae include anger, frustration, helplessness, desire for revenge, depressive symptoms, the eating problems, and the sleep disorder that are attendant with depression. Certainly encourage patients and their family members to talk about the experience, follow the normal routine, avoid alcohol and drugs, and realize that the return to normal will take time. Referral to psychologists, social workers, clinicians if the symptoms are persistent, or in particular patients that have difficulty in managing these feelings. Next slide. I want to focus for a few minutes on our United States military's experience. They have had sadly, significant experience in dealing with blast and explosive injuries. The military, to their credit, has been extraordinarily quick to seek and adopt new strategies in treating hemorrhage, the leading cause of preventable death in the kinds of injuries they're seeing abroad. The mortality rates have been dramatically lower for the current conflict than those in the past. Next slide. Some of the medical advances from the global war on terrorism include expanded use of damage control surgery, utilization of whole blood, tourniquets, hemostatic agents, and hemostatic dressings. Damage control surgery, I want to spend just a bit of time on. It's used to avoid the deadly triad that they've experienced over there of hypothermia, coagulopathy, and acidosis. The real goals of this damage control surgery is to stop the bleeding, remove major contaminants, leave the wound open, avoiding abdominal compartment syndrome. After the damage, that initial damage control surgery is done, the patient is then transferred to the intensive care unit where there's continued resuscitation, normalization of the blood pressure, temperature, and coagulation factors. Then, about 12 to 18 hours later, patients are returned to surgery for their definitive surgical procedures. Mass transfusion in the military experiences include fresh thawed plasma, their preference of colloid versus crystalloid, and then use of cryoprecipitate and recombinant factor 7A. As I mentioned these military experiences to you, we've been fortunate enough to learn from our military colleagues here at CDC, and indeed one of the partnership initiatives this year is to really actually gather those experiences and put that in a form that we can think about what makes sense to translate over here in our civilian sector. This is work in progress indeed. Next slide. Next, I want to go over system challenges. For any of you who have been responsible for the care of the injured patient, if you don't get the patient care piece coupled with the system piece, being both of them working in concert, if the system isn't right, you're going to have morbidity and mortality as a result of that, just as you do with the actual patient care. So what I'd like to do is share the civilian international experiences that we've been fortunate enough to learn from the medical folks who've cared for patients following those experiences. And they're divided up into a couple of sectors, both pre-hospital and hospital. And this is from a wide range of countries, cities that have experienced these bombings, as well as some meetings that CDC has convened in concert with partners to gather these international experiences. And four physicians from our division that had the opportunity to spend 4 days learning from everyone from trained security to the nurse in charge on the day of the Madrid bombing. So quite a range of experience that we've been able to learn from. Next slide. With reference to the pre-hospital arena, the anticipation in the future for multiple simultaneous attacks, not just one bomb going off, but potentially multiple bombs going off, also potentially different targets, as in the bombs that went off in London where you had both the buses and the trains be targeted. Interestingly, in one of our conversations with one of these city's medical care providers, they said we're really taking a look at the concept of frequency inhibitors for our ambulances to prevent some of these attacks when we go on into the scene. Expectation of enormous casualty numbers. As I mentioned, the one that is particularly striking, not that any of them are not, but the Madrid experience with 2,000 injuries. In discussing triage, and we do have an initiative on triage for mass casualties with our TIDE partners right now, but
in talking with one of the leads of pre-hospital response in one of these cities, I asked the question, well, how did it work out with the triage tags? This worked out okay? And you could hear a pin drop. There was a long pause, and he said, triage, are you kidding? Triage in this instance was alive versus dead, and I think that speaks to the issue of scalability is in what's manageable with large numbers. Then the other issue that I've actually alluded to earlier in some of the key concepts is the issue of closed versus open space. And there is a dramatic increase in injury severity in vehicles that have closed doors. And where this was particularly came to the forefront and was very compelling was we had heard this from a wide range of care providers, as in, well, we had these kinds of injuries in the people that were in the compartments with closed doors. But when we actually had some time with one of the train security folks, he said, oh, yeah, all the people that had the really, really bad injuries or they were already dead were in compartments with closed doors. And when not only the injured care providers but also the train security guard realized the difference between this, I think this is worth us paying attention to. Then, lastly, in the pre-hospital environment, the silence that has occurred, or near silence that has occurred at some of these events because of the tympanic membrane ruptures and not to mention the sheer psychological shock, but also the difficulty in communication with tympanic membrane ruptures. Next slide. For the hospital, one of the challenges, and I could just as soon put this on the pre-hospital slide, with the enormity of some of these events, while there have been, in some of these instances, regular EMS to hospital communications back and forth, for one of these events, there was virtually non-existent EMS to hospital communications, with hospital personnel learning about the event from family members or from victims who came into the hospital. So hopefully sometime in my lifetime we'll get to the issue of communications and disasters, but we haven't quite got this figured out well enough yet, as many of you know. Then, of all the things that I think I personally have learned from those international civilian experiences is, it would not be surprising if we were challenged by this as well, is the maldistribution of patients among hospitals. That was a critical issue, has been a critical issue. I've seen it in my own disaster experience, real-life experience, but have seen it in these kinds of events as well. And an example of that, in a very, very large-scale event, there in that city there are 15 hospitals, and two of the 15 hospitals received approximately 60% of the casualties. So figuring out how to truly distribute very large numbers, and I'm not talking about the bus crash where you have 15 patients, how you distribute those, but how you distribute very large numbers is a critical issue that I think we need to really work on in our communities and throughout the nation. And then and the enormity of the numbers of medical personnel required. And let me speak to that because I think this was another one of those take-home lessons that's pretty unforgettable. The hospital that received the largest number of patients in Madrid is an 1,800-bed hospital. And I've asked, but I don't believe in the United States we have an 1,800-bed hospital. It's the largest hospital I've ever seen in my life. And it turns out that the personnel on duty there were called upon to take care of the casualties they received. But in addition, what transpired was there truly was a shift change during all this. So what that meant was you had double the number of medical personnel for an 1,800-bed hospital caring for patients from this. And then lastly, the damage control surgery issue. It turns out that
every point of care really rose to the occasion by figuring out what damage control meant for their areas. Next slide. For the hospitals, they found that critical patients required lots of blood. For example, the closest hospital in Madrid that received patients, they saw 312 patients and admitted 91. The blood bank delivered 145 units of type-specific blood during the day, 90 of them in the first 4 hours, 60 units of FFP, and 75 units of platelets. That's a lot. Next slide. I think sort of bringing this all together for me was a quote from Dr. Fernando Torregano Fuentes and Dolores Perez Diaz from the University General Hospital at Gregorio Manyan in Madrid, Spain. And that quote is as follows. Mass casualty incidents in urban areas, although rare, are an increasing concern worldwide. Such concerns seem justified with the recent terrorist bombings in Bombay, India, in July 2006. The three urban mass casualty incidents that followed the events of 9/11 all have in common that the targets were crowded trains and a bus in London at the busiest times of the day. All the incidents imposed an enormous challenge on civilian medical services who were unaccustomed to dealing with events of that kind and the resulting injuries. Next slide. The resources that we have available or soon to be available on our website and also contacting us through COCA@cdc.gov will help you get this information if it's not easily available to you, is a course on bombings, injury patterns, and care. It's a one-hour module and three-hour seminar, and that's much of the material for this presentation was taken from that course. It was led by the American College of Emergency Physicians jointly with CDC and involved the TIDE partnership and many representatives from many other injury care organizations. We also just within the past week or so released a report that I believe is up on our website entitled In a Moment's Notice, Surge Capacity for Terrorist Bombings, Challenges and Proposed Solutions. And this includes specific recommendations for approximately nine different disciplines ranging from emergency medicine all the way to the blood bank and radiology and hospitalists. And then we have fact sheets for clinicians, but also fact sheets for pre-hospital care providers. This month, an article that resulted from one of our international meetings that we supported on this topic is entitled Blast-Related Injuries from Terrorism, an International Perspective, by Lerner et al. In Pre-Hospital Emergency Care. And we can get you that reference if you need. Next slide and last slide. So what if a bomb goes off and we are called to respond to that? I realize, as I'm sure you do, that without practice and experience, it's very difficult to do well in responding to anything. And in particular, it's very difficult to recall this kind of detailed information. We've approached this proactively with essentially trying to get awareness through education. This is one of those activities, but also reactively by pushing out information. And actually, the slide you see before you is the kind of information that we would actually be pushing out. We've actually had real-life experience in pushing information out about bomb injuries in response to the bombings in London and also two train bombings in India. We've also drilled pushing this information out in real time in the United States as well. In conclusion, I really hope this information has provided you with a level of awareness of the patient and the system challenges in preparing and responding to terrorist bombings, as well as some of the resources available, and hearing from our colleagues who've experienced these kinds of events. It's really clear that while there are some profound challenges in responding to terrorist bombings, it turns out that common sense, heroism, and the human spirit really do prevail. So hopefully this has been helpful to you. Thank you so much for your attention.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Hunt. That was an excellent presentation. I certainly think that we're going to have some questions with our group. I actually would like to ask one which may be on the minds of some of our listeners. Could you elaborate a little bit more about that that group of folks who may not have, you know, certain classical overt symptoms of blast lung injury, but, you know, may develop, you know, have gotten enough of a concussive wave to maybe have, you know, pulmonary contusions or develop symptoms later? Are there any kind of, you know, watch signs like, you know, dyspnea or hemoptysis, of course, but can you elaborate a little more on that of kind of what, kind of what, how long the window is, I guess, you know, 24 hours, 48 hours? I've heard kind of variable data on that.
Right. Well, I think you just spoke to it to some extent. I think just off the top, I don't think there's quite enough experience to give you a definitive answer. However, any sign at all of lung-related symptoms or signs certainly ought to key in on that. And the other thing is, you know, again, with my total clinical experience of one plus what we've been able to glean from folks in the literature, the proximity of the blast, I think, is something to key in on, and that's just basically extrapolating from learning from all this material. Dr. Sullivan, if you're on the line, do you have anything else to add to that? Ernie must not be on the line. Paula?
Just to point out clinically that in general with a pulmonary contusion, there will be other physical evidence of external chest trauma, such as rib fractures or contusions to the thorax, and these are typically missing in the classic blast lung. So that would be one clue in helping differentiate the contusion from primary blast lung. The probability of having a primary blast injury, it varies inversely with the cube of the distance from the epicenter. So in other words, the further the person is away from where the blast occurred, the much less likely they are to have primary blast injuries such as pulmonary blast, and an index of suspicion, present or absent, is going to be really important in making these diagnoses. Also, the difference in terms of the pressure that's required to sustain these types of injuries, typically in the tympanic membrane rupture, that's sustained at pressures of 5 or 6 pounds per square inch, whereas blast lung is more in the 40 to 50 pounds per square inch realm. So just kind of understanding the physics of all that helps you to evaluate the sense of the likelihood of there being a blast lung injury.
Great, thank you. Marianne, I think we'll open it up to callers' questions.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Our first question comes from Jonathan Adams of Penn State Hershey Medical Center.
Yes, on slide 19, your list of possibility of exposure to inhaled toxins included methemoglobin as an inhaled toxin. Is that what is meant, or is that a reaction to an inhaled toxin?
I believe that was what was meant with that. I'll double check on that, but I believe that was what was meant, not a reaction to.
How does one inhale methemoglobin?
I tell you what, on the methemoglobin one, if you, we will definitely get back to you with an expanded answer on that we'll have available for everyone.
Okay, great, thanks.
Our next question is from Dr. Singer of the University of Cincinnati.
Yeah, Dr. Hunt, with regard to the primary pulmonary blast injury, the so-called blast lung, you alluded to the Israeli experience where positive pressure, whether through a mask or through an endotracheal tube, was harmful and actually exacerbated the injury. And what I'm wondering is, do you have any knowledge or experience of the use of high-frequency jet ventilators for this purpose, specifically in the adult population?
I have not seen any literature with reference to high. I know exactly what you're speaking to, but I don't recall hearing about or seeing anything in the literature on it. I think it's a great question, though.
Thank you.
I don't have, you know, it's sort of like if I was to think about that in the emergency department, I'd be doing it de novo for the first time without any sort of background that said this is actually going to work or not work. I really don't know, but obviously keeping that in the back of your mind in terms of armamentarium makes a lot of sense.
Our next question is from Marvin Wayne of Whatcom County.
Yeah, hi, Rick. It's Marv. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Marv?
Good. A couple of comments. I've had the opportunity to work with the Israelis, getting over there quite a bit and working with them on some of these issues in both directions. I want to comment on the blast lung issue. I think you need to temporize that. I think what they're saying is not be overly vigorous initially in using a lot of positive pressure. However, they do use moderate positive pressure and other forms to treat the ARDS that secondarily develops. The other comment I would make is to reemphasize the issue of judicious use of fluids. If there was any message that several of the Israelis gave to me in working with them was, we think sometimes that we have to give a lot of fluid to resuscitate the general shock, but we end up doing is pushing it all into the lungs. So they really go on the low side of maintenance of normal pressures as far as systemic blood pressure and look mainly at perfusion. And the last question, Rick, is would you care to comment on the secondary missile effect of what people are putting into these incendiary devices? I know the Israelis, again, going back, and I think even in London, bolts, nails, or pieces of anything you can imagine, including old watches that are going into these devices. Would you comment on the need to be vigilant for those types of injury?
Yeah, there's a couple of points. Let me go back to your comment on the use of fluids. That's been reinforced. What you related has also been reinforced in discussions I've had with our international colleagues. A particular one that is memorable was with one terrorist bombing resulted in a lot of burn injuries. And so, you know, clinicians, much like I would approach it as if it was a burn injury and didn't realize, oh, by the way, it was in closed space and there might be pulmonary injury as well. And indeed, many of those patients ended up in the situation you alluded to with the fluid overload. So I think really thinking about, you know, okay, the lung injury and that we may create real problems with over-aggressive fluid management, always realizing that you've got to get the tissue perfusion. So I appreciate the reinforcement of that. In terms of the different kinds of things that terrorists are putting in these bombs, I guess my only comment is that they are extraordinarily creative in trying to find the most damaging type of things to put in these bombs. I mean, we've seen the pictures of the nails, the bolts, the ball bearings. Did you have any in particular, Marv, that you were thinking about of recent genre?
Only comment there was that just to remind people that we not only have to now deal with the primary blast, the secondary blast, the effect of the explosive itself, but also of these multi-missiles. And I think the comment about running out of external fixators and the like, because not only do we see the issues of the soft tissue and soft and solid organs, but also the bony structures that are being devastated by these missiles, secondary missiles, from that are packed into the bombs. And you know, it's sort of like an unbelievable effect of the Tinker Toys trying to put everything back together and having to think about it, but being very cautious in doing really a whole-body scan in the sense of these people, because it's been amazing to the Israelis, and I'm sure to others, that where they are dealing with what they think are the primary injuries, later when they do whole-body scans, they find these secondary missiles in distal portions of the body.
Yeah. Thanks.
Our next question is from Kathy Butler of UVA.
Hello.
with the blast injury, we can anticipate extensive victim and provider blood exposures from the spray and, I guess, the spillage also. Can you speak to exposure workup and HIV, Hep B prophylaxis treatment, and the challenges that would occur with such high volume needs?
Yeah, a couple comments. Number one, that is an area that we are actively pursuing here, okay? So it is not that we do not have a final, there is a CDC recommendation about that, okay? So let me say that off the top. And we realize that it is a very important issue that we've had multiple discussions about and ongoing initiatives to try to approach that proactively rather than after a bomb goes off. So A, I'm glad you brought it up, and no, we're not done. B, however, let me say this about it. We have learned about the kinds of experiences that various countries have had in approaching this, and also our military's had in approaching this. There's certainly the considerations of tetanus, the whole hepatitis issue, even the HIV issue. All those are considerations, and I guess if it was an answer today, I would say you would use your best clinical judgment based on how you've cared for other wounds, but also realize that in addition to the you get the administrative nurse in charge of the hospital in the middle of the night coming down and saying, I got this person up on floor B with a needle stick. The exposures to these kinds of injuries clearly are not the needle stick exposure. This is far beyond what our usual clinical experience is in terms of the contamination of these wounds with literally body parts contaminating body parts. So I think in approaching that, again, there is no formal CDC guidance at this juncture, but we're actively pursuing that, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Our next question is from Edward Cougar of Indiana Farm Bureau Insurance.
Yes, this morning there was a big article, well, not a big article, but in USA Today, titled Chlorine Bombs Pose New Terror Risk, and the article pretty much talked about some recent thefts of chlorine from water treatment companies in California. And after I read that, I got to thinking just the prevalence of chlorine. You can go to a pool supply place and for 99 cents get a gallon. You can go to Walmart or any other supermarket, and for, under a dollar, get a gallon of basically bleach, which is, almost the equivalent of chlorine. And it seems that the potential for that is just kind of all over the place. Any comments or thoughts on that?
Yeah, a very, very specific comment. I have not read the USA Today article. I'm aware of the chlorine exposures, and coincidentally, because of this particular conference call, I ended up canceling a meeting with one of the folks who directs much of the preparedness and response for the National Center for Environmental Health. And this issue of chlorine and other types of hazardous materials that may end up in bombs is certainly a topic for our discussion. So it's not that we haven't thought about it, but I think one of the things that I've learned over the past couple of years and starting to learn about this is what bomb terrorists are doing today will not necessarily be what terrorists are going to be doing tomorrow. You just alluded to it. They're changing, the tactics are changing, and it behooves us to really stay on top of what the current trends are, and we'll try our best to do that. So I'm glad you brought it up, and it indeed will be a topic for our discussion.
Our next question is from Teresa Baker of University of Louisville Hospital.
Yes, Dr. Hunt. I have a question regarding the limited resources available for burn injuries. In the Madrid explosion, obviously there was a lot of burn injuries. What is your experience with the burn surge capacity on a hospital with limited resources just in burns alone?
Yeah, right. I am very much aware of the burns as being a significant issue, and there has been a considerable attentiveness to HHS and DHS on the burn issue itself. And for that reason, it's not like we're not interested in paying attention to it, but I think that we can probably find the kinds of resources that would be helpful to hospitals that we can refer people on the call to. We just got to access that, and I think we can do it pretty quickly. I know the American Burn Association has been very engaged with government officials on the development of resources to be able to not just, you know, provide more burn beds. I mean, that, yeah, that's the holy grail of can we have more burn beds, but indeed helping with training issues and how to have folks that aren't so familiar with taking care of burns become more familiar. I know there's a lot of activity around that issue, and we'll work on trying to find those resources for you.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Great. Well, Dr. Hunt and colleagues, thank you again so much. What I'd like the callers, if you didn't get a chance to ask your question, please send it via email to COCA@cdc.gov. That's COCA@cdc.gov, and we will, try to, shunt those over to Dr. Hunt and his team and get more explicit answers for you. Also, what we plan to do is send an update reminder, just kind of recapping the call and saying the information that Mary Ann's about to provide about the replay number, but we'll also include some of the resources that Dr. Hunt went over in his talk. So without further ado, thank you once more for presenting on this very informative call, and Mary Ann, I'll let you close.
Thank you for joining today's conference call. If you would like to listen to the replay, you may dial 1-800-297-0781. Again, that replay number is 1-800-297-0781. The replay will be available through May 8, 2007. Thank you.